Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 100, What a Massacre. Thanks for joining me. As always, before we get started, I'd like to invite you to join us on Patreon. I just released the 9th of our dispatches, the bonus episodes available exclusively to Patreon subscribers. These have been a lot of fun for me, and the Patreon supporters seem to be enjoying them as well. I actually had someone tell me they've been enjoying the dispatches more than the regular episodes. So I think by this point, it's safe to say that if you're not signed up on Patreon, you're missing out on about a third of the show. So I hope you'll consider joining us. Anyway. Well, we finally reached episode 100. I thought about doing something special to mark the occasion, but once I realized we were on pace to have the Battle of Eylau as episode 100, I figured that was occasion enough. Eylau is maybe the most mysterious of the major battles of Napoleon's career. There are different, contesting versions of a lot of the stories I am about to tell you. The horrible conditions of the campaign, and the near-constant snowstorms during the battle, made it very difficult for the participants to understand what was going on around them. And, as we'll see, after the battle, the leadership of both sides had incentive to fudge the truth about what really happened over those two horrible days. I should also take the opportunity to warn you that this was a very violent battle. It's always difficult to strike a balance in depicting the horrible bloodshed of this period. I don't want to get too graphic and risk making the show completely repulsive, but I do feel some obligation to depict what these people went through. Almost everyone who fought at Eylau commented on the unusual level of carnage, and we will be talking about that. So use your judgment if you are sensitive to violence or listening with your children. Before we dive into the stunning events of Eylau, we should remind ourselves of the condition of the two armies. This is almost starting to feel a bit redundant. Every one of the last few episodes in the narrative has included a long section describing the misery of the French and coalition forces, but the destitution of these armies is central to the story. In short, little had changed over the last few weeks. Food shortages were critical on both sides. In theory, the French logistics system was better organized, more professional, and had more resources. However, in the rugged Polish terrain and punishing winter weather, this doesn't seem to have translated into much better performance. Soldiers on both sides reported that they sometimes went days without rations, forced to rely on foraging to feed themselves, which was not an easy proposition in this poor, sparsely populated part of the world. Even senior officers sometimes went without food. The weather was still bad. It was freezing cold, and both sides had to deal with biting wind and heavy snow. It was miserable, but there was a silver lining. Mud was no longer as much of a factor as it had been in the month or two previous. Thanks to the rotten weather, all that mud was now mostly frozen or buried under a layer of tightly packed snow. These were still far from ideal conditions for rapid movement, especially for heavy, cumbersome things like wagons and artillery, but both armies had regained some of their mobility. Exhaustion and low morale remained pervasive on both sides. Units struggled to keep up their strength as men dropped out of the ranks, unable to continue marching, or slipped away to search for food or shelter. However, as we've seen repeatedly in past episodes, neither army had totally lost its fighting spirit. Both French and coalition soldiers had displayed incredible toughness and resilience in this phase of the war. One aspect of all this misery that we haven't yet discussed is that the three branches of service did not suffer equally. The artillery had it the worst. Moving heavy cannons across this landscape was often simply impossible. They sometimes spent days more or less stationary, just struggling to get their guns over some particularly difficult stretch of ground. We've already talked at length about how badly the infantry was suffering, sometimes struggling to find the will to go on, according to primary sources. However, things were not quite so bad for the cavalry. Their superior mobility allowed them to roam further in search of food. Horses have a much easier time navigating mud and snow than human beings. And even in the poorest, emptiest parts of Poland, there was often grass or hay for horses to eat. If you look through the military history of Eastern Europe and compare it to the West, you'll find that armies were often much smaller and often much more focused on cavalry, In the Napoleonic Wars, you typically expect around 5-15% of any given army to be cavalry. In the Golden Age of the Polish Commonwealth, they often fielded armies that were around half cavalry. Quite simply, if you were going to be on campaign in this part of the world before the invention of the train and the automobile, it really helped to be on horseback. As we've discussed in past episodes, the terrain here was fundamentally different from anything the French had encountered in Western Europe. In some ways, this area was more comparable to the Central Asian steppe or the American Great Plains than to anything in France, Italy, or Germany. And think of the armies that had flourished in those areas. The Huns, the Mongols, the Sioux, the Comanche. This was cavalry country. As a result, on the eve of Eylau, the horsemen of both armies were generally in slightly better shape than the infantry and artillery. This was especially true of the French, who had captured a huge number of high-quality, well-trained war horses during the invasion of Prussia. The Prussians were widely regarded as the best military horse breeders in Europe, and those ranches being under French control gave Napoleon's cavalry a real advantage. In spite of the horrible conditions, the recent battles and skirmishes between the two armies had been hotly contested, although mostly inconclusive. In the preceding months, French and Russian forces had looked more or less evenly matched, with perhaps a slight edge to the Grande Armée. Surprisingly, that held true for the two commanders as well. Obviously, Napoleon was still Napoleon, and his opponent, General Count Levin August von Bennigsen, was mostly untested as an army commander, famous more for his role in the murder of Emperor Paul I than for any military achievement. However, despite their very different reputations, their performances in this campaign so far had strangely mirrored each other. Major battles had been mostly draws. Bennigsen had attempted a bold surprise offensive, but had been foiled by bad luck. Napoleon had used this failure to attempt his own surprise offensive, but had, in turn, been foiled by bad luck. On the eve of Eylau, Bennigsen had chosen a good position for a defensive battle, a series of ridge lines just outside the town of Eylau. The Grande Armée was more spread out, with fewer troops concentrated near the main body of the enemy. However, Napoleon had good incentive to attack, because, in theory, he had an opportunity to threaten both flanks of the more concentrated Russians, cut off their retreat to their main base at Königsberg, and inflict a devastating defeat, possibly even surrounding Bennigsen and forcing him to surrender. This all might sound familiar to you because it's almost exactly the same scenario as the Battle of Pultusk, fought about 6 weeks earlier, the main difference being that both forces were larger. However, we don't know exactly how much larger. Here's where we get into the first big mystery of the battle. Estimates of the number of troops involved vary wildly. Depending on who you ask, Napoleon had between 60 and 90,000 men at his disposal. Low estimates place Bennigsen's strength at 67,000, and high estimates at 76,000. Part of the reason for the confusion is that neither army was fully concentrated when the fighting began. Both sides would spend much of the battle waiting for large contingents to arrive. For the French, Marshal Ney and VI Corps were expected along the left, and Marshal Davout's III Corps along the right. These were the forces Napoleon hoped to use to turn the enemy flanks, hopefully achieving his encirclement. Bennigsen would be waiting on his allies, the remains of the Prussian army under General Anton von Lestock. The Prussians had been worn down to well under 10,000 men, but they had recovered from the humiliations of the previous autumn and were eager to fight. Lestock's troops had performed well in several recent skirmishes. Many of the great battles we've covered in this show were set pieces. Both sides developed a clear plan, deployed their forces, and then, on the day of battle, tried to execute those plans. Eylau would be different. Neither side was fully deployed when the fighting began, and neither commander had a clearly defined plan he was trying to follow. Bennigsen wanted to hold his ground and inflict losses on the French, and Napoleon wanted to hold the enemy in place and then work around their flanks. But neither general had a clear vision of how to achieve these objectives. Both would be improvising. This would be a messy battle to cap off a messy campaign. The two armies made contact on the afternoon of February 7th, 1807, Marshal Murat's Reserve Cavalry Corps and the advance units of Marshal Soult's 4th Corps encountered a strong Russian rearguard under Prince Pyotr Bagration, a brilliant, hard-living Georgian who we've met in previous episodes. Bagration had orders to hold off the French. Bennigsen was still preparing his line on that high ground outside Eylau. His artillerymen were having trouble moving their guns across the narrow roads and snowy ground. He placed Bagration and a second detachment under General Michael Andreas Barclay de Tolly directly in the path of the Grande Armée to screen his struggling artillery from the French. Murat and Soult saw the opportunity and immediately attacked. We've seen this style of engagement several times in this campaign. A desperate Russian rearguard trying to hold off superior French numbers. As typically happened in these engagements, the French advanced and inflicted severe losses on the Russians, but failed to trap or destroy them. The Russians were so hard-pressed, they were forced to leave behind their wounded, and even a large number of French prisoners, captured earlier in the campaign. The retreating Russians made a stand in the town of Eylau itself. The buildings and stone walls made this a highly defensible location. The French attempted a frontal assault and were repulsed. They charged again, but again the Russians held firm. French casualties were so heavy that the Russian positions were ringed by a pile of bodies. A Russian officer would later recall, quote, "From the house corners, windows, and roofs, the musket balls poured down like hail," end quote. It seems almost too perfect, but some of the heaviest fighting took place in the town cemetery. At this point, the Russian commander, General Barclay, collapsed. At first, people thought he had been hit. This would have been his second wound in 2 days. You might remember from last episode that he had been wounded at the Battle of Hof, not quite 24 hours earlier. As it turned out, Barclay had been hiding the seriousness of his wound. He was still bleeding, and the combination of blood loss and exhaustion had pushed him past his limit. Other sources claim Barclay was actually hit again, this time by grapeshot from a French cannon. In any case, he would live, but was definitely out of the fight. Shortly after the general was carried off the field, the French attacked a third time, and finally, this attack gained momentum. As the French surged forward, a group of Russians barricaded themselves in the town mill and were surrounded. The French set fire to the building, and the Russians were forced to run out to escape the smoke and flames, where they were immediately killed by the French. Finally, as the sun began to set, the Grande Armée secured the town. Then, Bennigsen seems to have changed his mind. All this fighting was supposed to be nothing more than a delaying action, to ensure the rest of the Russian army had time to get into position. But once the fighting inside Eylau began to wind down, Bennigsen decided he didn't like how close the outlying buildings were to the Russian line, and so he sent reinforcements to continue the struggle. The Russians approached in silence, so as not to give away their positions. Then, at the last minute, let loose the traditional Russian battle cry, "Ooh-rah!" and charged with the bayonet. Once again, the town was the scene of bitter street fighting, and within about half an hour, much of it was back under Russian control. The tide of the battle seemed to be shifting, but as their units surged forward, many of the starving Russian troops paused to search nearby buildings for food. Frustrated, a Russian colonel ordered his drummers to beat out the call to assemble, hoping to gather these wayward men and redirect them back towards the attack. However, his intentions were misunderstood. Many of the men who actually were fighting turned around and rushed backwards to assemble around the colonel. The momentum of the assault was totally lost, and the Russian leadership now saw no alternative but to fall back to the main line, just outside town. For hours, the Russian rearguard had struggled against superior French numbers. They had paid dearly for their obstinance, but they had succeeded in their mission. As the fighting raged, those Russian guns finally reached the main line, and the rest of the army prepared themselves for a defensive battle. Bennigsen had his position, and he was determined to hold it, come what may. The sun sets early in Poland at this time of the year. There would be no time to set up a proper encampment, and so both armies prepared to spend an uneasy night out in the open, in freezing cold. According to one source, the temperature got as low as 7 degrees Fahrenheit, or minus 13.8 Celsius. A French officer described seeing men with scorches on their faces and clothing from huddling so close to their campfires. Unable to find enough food for their horses, the men of the French cavalry fed their mounts straw from the thatched roofs of nearby houses. One French officer found space in a barn for a few hours' rest, only to wake up utterly confused, finding himself in the open under the night sky. As he rested, the cavalry had stripped all the straw from the roof, and then the infantry took the wooden boards from the walls to use for firewood. Only a few timbers remained. Things were even worse in the Russian lines. In order to keep his numbers and exact positions concealed, Bennigsen had forbidden the lighting of campfires. Understandably, in both armies, many of the men found it impossible to sleep, and many of their officers were obliged to stay up, making the final preparations for the confrontation that was sure to come in the morning. The second day of battle would be fought by totally exhausted men. As the evening wore on, and both armies settled into their uneasy rest, something surprising happened. Something none of the senior leadership on either side had planned for. The battle resumed early. A firefight broke out inside Eylau between French and Russian patrols. Hearing the sound of gunfire, nearby units rushed to the scene and joined in. As the scale of the fighting increased, it got louder. More units heard the noise and rushed into the town. Soon, junior officers engaged in this fighting were sending out calls for reinforcements, and even more soldiers streamed into Eylau. On their own momentum, without the guidance of any senior leadership on either side, thousands of men had become engaged in a real pitched battle in the darkened streets of the town. This is another great mystery about this battle. Accounts vary wildly as to how this all started. After the fighting, Napoleon claimed he had sent patrols into the town to secure shelter. These patrols had then unexpectedly encountered Russian patrols, and the fighting escalated from there. However, there is not much evidence for this assertion, and most historians dismiss it. The fact that this major skirmish had broken out without orders did not reflect well on the Grande Armée or its leadership, so Bonaparte had an obvious incentive to pretend otherwise. Other sources claim that French soldiers entered the town looking for shelter under their own initiative, motivated by desperation to escape the cold, not by orders. There, they encountered a Russian patrol, or were spotted by a nearby Russian unit who then sent men to drive them off, and the fighting escalated. There is also a slightly more interesting story. According to some sources, the men in charge of Napoleon's baggage train made a mistake, deciding to set up the emperor's lodging and headquarters in a building inside the town that was far too close to the Russian lines. The Russians sent men into the town hoping to capture the baggage train, and were greeted by members of the Imperial Guard, who had been assigned to protect Napoleon's documents and possessions, and the fighting then escalated from there. In any case, thousands of men were now engaged in intense street fighting in freezing darkness. This was really brutal combat, not much more than a brawl, with no one in command on either side, and the darkness, confusion, and unfamiliar streets making it impossible for anyone to tell what was going on. You have to imagine that the freezing cold added an intensity to the proceedings. Frenchmen and Russian alike knew that the winners of this fight would have a chance for a few hours' rest indoors, next to a warm hearth. The senior commanders should have stopped this unauthorized skirmish, but none on either side took any serious steps to do so. Maybe they knew what capturing the town meant to their freezing, exhausted troops, and didn't dare stand in the way. After hours of frantic, confused fighting, the men of the Grande Armée won out. Eylau was slightly closer to the French lines, which gave them an advantage, and as we've seen several times during this campaign, although the Russians were much more of a match for the French than the Austrians or Russians, generally speaking, Napoleon's soldiers still had the edge in a straight-up fight. Once they finally secured the town, French soldiers crammed themselves into every building in Eylau to get a few hours' fitful rest before the carnage that would ensue in the morning. Estimates are sketchy, but perhaps as many as 8,000 men were killed or wounded in this unsanctioned fight for the town. This pre-battle skirmish had caused almost as many casualties as several entire engagements from the War of the First Coalition, only a little over a decade earlier. Warfare was evolving. Armies were getting bigger, and generals were concentrating more of their men for major battles. The fighting that ensued tended to be more intense. This skirmish in the town would prove to be an omen for what would come the next day, a frantic, disorganized brawl between desperate men, resulting in a complete bloodbath. As the two armies tried to rest, Napoleon considered his options. He had a rough idea of a plan: to hold Bennigsen in position, bring up reinforcements along the enemy flanks, and try to envelop them. However, he was not convinced the Russians would stand and fight. We saw this happen in many other engagements in this campaign, the Russians fighting rearguard or delaying actions, inflicting losses on the French, and then falling back in the night, rather than facing the full weight of the Grande Armée. But the Emperor had misread Bennigsen's intentions. The Russians had more of their forces concentrated, including a significant advantage in artillery. They had good positions on high ground. They too were expecting reinforcements. Bennigsen had finally chosen his moment. The Russian leadership believed that in the hills outside Eylau, they would deliver Napoleon his first major defeat. To the chagrin of both sides, the weather got even worse in the night. The snowfall got heavier and heavier, and that cold, biting wind grew stronger. By dawn, there were blizzard conditions across the whole battlefield. This blizzard would be the single most important feature of the battle, even more so than the terrain. The terrific smoke and noise caused by early 19th century gunpowder weapons made every battle of this era a confusing affair. But at Eylau, the combatants sometimes couldn't see more than a few paces in front of them. This level of snow and wind also had a dampening effect on sound. Loud noises, like the crackle of musket volleys or the booming of cannon, were still audible, but didn't travel nearly as far. Smaller noises, like human voices, the jangles of equipment on moving troops, or footfalls, were almost totally muted. This meant you could be standing almost right next to an enemy unit without realizing they were there. There is debate over who fired the first shots of the second day of battle. Some sources claim Bennigsen ordered his artillery to open up, hoping this would prevent the French from discovering that he had slightly shortened his line during the night. Others claim the firing started more or less spontaneously, and that it is unknown which side fired first. In any case, sometime shortly after dawn, some artillery officer on one side or the other opened fire on the enemy. On the other side, another battery responded, aiming for the muzzle flashes of the enemy guns, briefly visible through the blizzard. Soon, the two armies were engaged in a full-blown artillery duel, 300 French guns and 400 Russian, hammering away at each other in the weak morning light. They were roughly evenly matched. The Russians had the numbers, but the French batteries had been deployed more skillfully. According to one scholar of this battle, this was the largest cannonade ever witnessed up to this point in history. Maybe that's true for a pitched battle on land, but I have to imagine that there were naval engagements and sieges that saw more cannon firing all at once. In any case, it was a hellish few hours for both sides. There was not much cover on the battlefield, and the soldiers suffered terribly. A young Russian staff officer described the cannon fire as, quote, "a vast hurricane of death that seemed to smash and erase from the earth everything in its path," end quote. Behind the French lines, the commander of the Mounted Grenadiers of the Imperial Guard, one of the most elite units in the army, saw his officers ducking and wincing as enemy fire landed near their position. He felt this set a bad example for the men, and admonished them, quote, "Heads up! That's grape shot, not shit," end quote. Eventually, the gunners of the Grande Armée gained the upper hand, but the Russian guns were not silenced. Both sides would suffer heavy casualties to artillery fire throughout the day. Meanwhile, fighting had broken out once again on the outskirts of Eylau. Dawn seems to have reminded the men in this sector of the battlefield just how close their lines were. The closest French-occupied buildings were actually within musket range of the Russian position. On the French right, Marshal Davout's Third Corps started the morning early, beginning their march at 5, before dawn. Despite the blizzard, they had made good progress towards the battlefield. Their advance units would soon appear in the no-man's land just beyond Bennigsen's left flank, held only by a thin screen of Cossacks. Napoleon had to attack. He worried the fighting in the town of Eylau might escalate and lead Bennigsen to launch a major attack on the town, and he needed to distract them from Davout's arrival on their left flank. A strong attack would also pin down their forces, hopefully preventing a quick response to Davout. We've seen this stratagem before. It was one of Napoleon's favorites. Pin down the center, then work around the flanks. He chose one of his most reliable subordinates to lead the main spearhead, Marshal Augereau, the tough-talking brawler from the Paris slums, who had been by Napoleon's side since Italy. However, Augereau was not in top form. Like many who fought in this campaign, the combination of exhaustion, bad food, and constant cold had made Augereau sick. In fact, that very morning, he had actually asked Napoleon to be relieved of command of 7th Corps. The Emperor had ordered him to stay at his post for just one more day, and Augereau relented, telling Napoleon that he would lead his men even if they had to drag him in a sledge. The messenger who brought Augereau the order to attack from Napoleon's headquarters was torn apart by a Russian cannonball in front of the entire staff of 7th Corps. Not a good omen. As Augereau prepared to lead the attack, he was so weak his aides had to help him into the saddle. Led by their ailing marshal, the two infantry divisions of 7th Corps formed assault columns and marched off into the blizzard. Russian line was not really a line, but more of a zigzag pattern, backed up by a secondary line just behind the first. Augereau's objective was the closest part of the zigzag, where it jutted out towards the French lines. In a typical battle, this would be a routine maneuver, and I would jump right into describing the fighting between Augereau's corps and the men of the Russian center. However, Eylau was anything but typical. As they marched into the low ground between the two armies, the blizzard picked up. Augereau and his men could no longer clearly see their objective. Without a visual reference point, the slope of the heights redirected 7th Corps. Rather than marching directly towards that protruding zig in the Russian lines, they unwittingly veered around it, aiming instead for the concave zag of the enemy position, exposing their flank to the Russian infantry and aiming almost directly for the largest of the Russian artillery batteries, right under the sights of 70 enemy cannon. Then disaster struck. One of the Russian gunners described what happened next. Quote, "A strong blizzard blinded us with snow. Suddenly, everything calmed down, and directly in front of my cannon, no more than 30 paces away, we saw a column of Frenchmen, who were also startled by the proximity of our line. My cannon were loaded with grapeshot, since I had no round shot, and only 5 rounds of grapeshot per gun. The grapeshot had a devastating effect at such close range. The column veered right and charged the 2nd Battalion of the Vladimirsky Regiment. I stood in the interval between the 2nd and 1st Battalion. Our men received the enemy with bayonets, but the French broke through the middle. I was still firing the last remaining grapeshot rounds when the artillerymen behind me shouted, 'Frenchmen!' and made me look around. Several Frenchmen stormed into the battery from behind, but they were soon followed by our men and were all stabbed with bayonets. I was able to save only a few of them from the swords of my men. Our horses were wounded and all the ammunition was used up. The bayonet melee ended with the complete destruction of the enemy column. Mounds of corpses marked the site of the carnage." End quote. Augereau's men tried to fight back as best they could, but thanks to the blizzard, they had walked right into a vertex of enemy muskets and cannon. Behind them, French artillery opened up, trying to provide a little cover, but they could barely see the fighting, and many of their rounds fell on their own men. The ailing Marshal Augereau was wounded. The commander of the 1st Division, General Desjardins, was killed, and the commander of the 2nd Division, General Oudelet, was badly wounded and had to be rushed to the rear. Augereau was only lightly injured, so he would stay in the field. He was now the only member of the Corps' senior leadership still in command. Some units were mowed down so quickly and so completely that the corpses lay in discernible formations, as if they had all dropped dead from heart attacks at the same moment. Another Russian officer described the carnage. Quote, "The French tried to fall back, but it was too late, since our regiments flanked the two forward battalions of each regiment, surrounded them, and began to destroy them, applying the good old Russian bayonet. We were reinforced by considerable forces of infantry and cavalry, and horrifying piles of enemy corpses soon filled the valley in front of the town. Together with my company, I was also involved in enacting the vengeance of the hardened heart amidst the horrors of war never before seen among the snowdrifts of the northern realms. But my martial fury soon subsided and was replaced by heartfelt sorrow when our enraged soldiers, having crushed and destroyed everything in front of them, began to tear apart with bayonets the corpses of the enemy, seeking the still living Frenchmen underneath them." End quote. Those who could ran, but many were trapped. The Russians seized the initiative, brought forward reinforcements, and closed the triangle around the spearhead of the doomed corps. Many of Augereau's men panicked, but the soldiers of the 14th Regiment of the Line held their nerve. One of their officers found a small patch of high ground and formed a square. From his position, the sick and wounded Marshal Augereau could just barely see the square of the 14th through the snow. He sent one of his aides to ride through the Russian gauntlet to order the regiment to retreat, but the man went down to a musket shot. He sent another. This man, too, went down. This process repeated until Augereau picked a man we know from past episodes, Lieutenant Marcelin Marbeau, whose memoirs I have quoted from many times. Marbeau finally made it through, found the senior surviving officer, a major, and relayed Augereau's instructions. However, by now, it was too late. The major told him, quote, "I can see no way of saving the regiment. Return to the Emperor and give him the farewells of the 14th of the Line, which has faithfully carried out his orders, and take him the eagle he gave us, which we can no longer defend. It would be too terrible to see it fall into enemy hands during our last moments." End quote. There was no chance of the infantryman of the 14th marching out of the trap. But, mounted on his horse, Marbeau did stand a chance. He took the eagle and galloped back towards the French lines. Even in the middle of a blizzard, that shining gold standard attracted a lot of attention. The Russians tore off after him. Marbeau and his horse were both hit several times, but they didn't slow down. Somehow he managed to ride right through the prongs of the Russian trap as they closed around 7th Corps. The eagle was saved. Other sources tell a slightly different story, that the unfortunate major of the 14th was killed before he could pass the eagle to Marbeau, that Marbeau galloped back empty-handed, and the eagle was taken by the Russians. Marbeau himself doesn't mention the incident at all in his memoirs, which seems a bit strange. In any case, the men of the 14th held on bravely, but after a heroic struggle, they made the mistake of opening their square to let in survivors from other regiments. An officer of the Pavlovsky Grenadier Regiment saw the opportunity and ordered a charge. The Russians were able to reach the square before it could be reformed. Enemy grenadiers streamed into the formation, and the whole regiment was massacred. Large numbers of men from 7th Corps were able to escape. The still-ongoing blizzard helped provide cover for many of the survivors. However, for all practical purposes, Augereau's corps had been destroyed. The survivors fell back towards their starting positions, just outside Eylau, pursued by the enemy. When the sick, wounded marshal was finally able to rally the remnants of his corps, there were only about 3,000 men, still unhurt and in good order. 7th Corps fell back so far that their pursuers came within about 100 yards, or 91 meters, of Napoleon's headquarters. The Emperor's personal bodyguards were forced to launch a desperate counterattack. They succeeded in blunting the Russian advance, but at a tremendous cost. The destruction of Augereau's corps has to rank as the worst setback experienced by a French army since Napoleon took power. It should be said that this fiasco actually did achieve some of its objectives. While the Russians were busy slaughtering Augereau's men, Marshal Davout and 3rd Corps had been able to get into position, and they were now putting severe pressure on Bennigsen's left flank. However, the massacre of 7th Corps had put the rest of the Grande Armée in terrible jeopardy. Bennigsen now had a huge number of troops concentrated in the center of the battlefield, and Napoleon had lost almost all of his infantry in this sector. If Bennigsen counterattacked now, there would not be much stopping him from punching right through Napoleon's center, splitting the Grande Armée in two, and practically guaranteeing a Russian victory. But the Emperor had never been the type of commander to sit around and wait for the enemy to make their move. Even now, after suffering one of the worst disasters of his whole career, he would seek to control the tempo of the battle and maintain the initiative. Napoleon ordered his center to attack again. That might sound insane, given what had just happened, but most of Napoleon's remaining strength in the center was cavalry, who were pretty ineffective fighting on the defensive, but incredibly powerful on the attack. They would fare much better charging the Russian lines than they would trying to stand their ground in the face of a strong counterattack. And so, Napoleon turned to his old friend and brother-in-law, Marshal Joachim Murat, gestured towards the Russians, and asked him, quote, "Are you going to let those fellows devour us?" End quote. He ordered Murat to attack with all of the Reserve Cavalry Corps, and lent him the mounted units of the Imperial Guard as well. This would be over 10,000 horsemen all launching themselves at the Russian lines together in a single attack. Nearly one out of every six French soldiers on the battlefield would be riding out with Murat. In European warfare of this era, a cavalry charge at this scale was almost unheard of. This was more the type of thing you might see in the Middle East with a Mamluk army. In fact, Napoleon's own tiny regiment of Mamluks, brought back from Egypt, would participate in the attack. A big Western European cavalry charge of this era was typically a few thousand men, and against a soft target, not right into the center of a prepared enemy position in the face of artillery. But, as they say, desperate times call for desperate measures. As we discussed earlier in the episode, the French cavalry was in relatively good shape compared to the rest of the army, and Murat and his generals were optimistic as they formed their men into two gigantic parallel attack columns, stretching all the way back beyond the French rear. With the poor visibility, the men at the back of the columns could barely even see the front. As always, Murat would charge alongside his men. He was still wearing that outlandish Polish warlord costume we've discussed in previous episodes, looking like a cross between Santa Claus and the Angel of Death, although for this bloody mission, he had traded in his jeweled riding crop for a saber. Many of the Russian units in the center of the battlefield were out of position, from their recent pursuit of the remains of Augereau's corps. They were still threatening, but not prepared to face a mass cavalry charge. The flamboyant marshal drew his sword and began to trot forward, alongside more than 10,000 of the best horsemen in Europe. One of the greatest cavalry charges in history had begun. Those Russian columns at the center of the battlefield were taken completely by surprise. Now it was the Russians' turn to stand helplessly and be cut down by an overwhelming enemy. A French cavalry officer would later remember, quote, "The brave phalanx of infantry was soon leveled to the earth, like a wheat field swept by a hurricane." End quote. Murat had succeeded at his primary mission. The center of the Grande Armée was out of immediate danger, but he had no intention of stopping. The two French assault columns were so long, most of his men hadn't even engaged yet. Murat and his generals would carry the momentum of the charge as far as they could. One column pressed forward, while the other veered right, to spread the damage towards Bennigsen's left, where Davout's corps was pushing forward. Many of the hapless Russian units in the path of the charge could not see or hear the advancing French until it was too late to form a square. Still, they opened fire on the French horsemen to deadly effect. Hundreds of cavalrymen fell, but it was not enough to stop the momentum of the charge. The French slammed into the main enemy line. In some places, the Russians were scattered like bowling pins by the units at the front of the column, and then ridden down and killed or captured by those that followed. In other places, resistance was more stiff, and the French had to charge multiple times before they could overwhelm their enemies. Still, the momentum of the charge was nowhere near spent. Murat and other commanders fanned out to attack other nearby Russian units, while Marshal Bessières, commander of the Imperial Guard, continued to push forward into Bennigsen's reserve. We can only imagine how surprised these units must have been, thinking of themselves as behind the action, waiting to go into battle, and then suddenly finding almost all of the French cavalry right on top of them. The whole Russian center was in pandemonium. In the raging blizzard, panicked men didn't know where to run. Everywhere, French horsemen who had peeled off from the main body of the charge were riding around with bloody sabers, hunting down and killing any Russian they could see. Other French troopers dismounted and took the time to disable most of the Russian cannon in this sector, which had been abandoned by their crews. Deep in the Russian rear, a bold group of the mounted grenadiers of the Imperial Guard had pushed much farther than anyone else, and soon found themselves nearly alone in a mass of Russian infantry. They were led by Colonel Louis Lepic, who had so crudely told his officers to keep their heads up earlier in the day. Once the Russians realized how few Frenchmen were still chasing them, they found their nerve, turned around, and surrounded this small group. A Russian officer called out in French, quote, "Surrender, Colonel! Your bravery has carried you too far. You are within our lines," end quote. Lepic called back to him, quote, "Look at these faces and see if they mean anything like surrender," end quote. He then turned to his troopers and called out, quote, "Follow me, men," end quote, and spurred his horse back towards the French lines. Despite heavy casualties, this small body of men was able to cut their way through the Russians back to safety. Further back, the biggest officer in the Grande Armée, the cuirassier general Jean-Joseph d'Hautpoul, charged towards a Russian square. He and his horse punched right through it, avoiding the raised bayonets and bowling over both ranks of infantry. The square was broken. However, the Russians were able to close the gap before any of d'Hautpoul's cuirassiers could follow. He was alone, inside the enemy formation. He was last seen falling from his horse, surrounded by Russian infantry. Other sources claim d'Hautpoul was hit in the leg by a Russian grapeshot round and slowly bled out among his own men. Whatever the case, he did not survive the charge. You might remember from episode 99 that after the Battle of Hoth, Napoleon had been so pleased with d'Hautpoul that he had embraced him in front of the whole division. D'Hautpoul had told the emperor that the only way to thank him for this honor would be to get killed in his service. Less than 2 days later, he made good on that promise. Writing of d'Hautpoul's death in his memoirs, Marcellin Marbeau ends the story with this sentence, quote, "Such were the men of that time," end quote. After charging nearly a mile and a half, or about 2.2 kilometers, Murat finally called a halt. He and his men had torn a huge, bloody hole right through the center of the Russian position. Now they found themselves alone, unsupported by infantry or artillery, right in the middle of the enemy army. The only thing left for them to do was reform and charge again. Murat and his generals rallied their men and reassembled their units into another assault column, and then did it all over again, smashing right through another section of the Russian lines, this time from the rear. This second charge took the French cavalry almost right back to where they started, in Napoleon's center. Murat's wild ride was finally over. Around 1,500 French horsemen had been killed, wounded, or captured by the Russians, just short of 15% of the men who had galloped forward less than an hour earlier. Russian casualties from the charge are almost impossible to calculate. There were around 15,000 men in those assault columns that had been dispersed at the beginning of the charge. Those units were now totally destroyed, but we don't know how many of the men were killed and wounded versus how many had run off into the blizzard and were only temporarily separated from the army. There were surely even more casualties when the French broke through the main line and charged the reserve. However, the exact number of men killed and wounded during the French charge is not as important as the overall effect it had on the Russians. Bennigsen's forces in the center and center left of the battlefield were in chaos. So many men were killed and wounded, and so many of the survivors totally dispersed, that command and control had almost totally broken down. The ongoing blizzard made rallying and reorganizing the masses of panicked men very difficult. Obviously, the Russians needed to bring in men from the reserve to plug the gaps. But, as we know, the reserve had also been charged by the French, and was also in chaos. At the height of the charge, French horsemen had advanced so deep into the Russian rear that they had actually been visible from the Russian headquarters with the naked eye. To his credit, Bennigsen did not panic, although apparently some of the younger and less experienced members of his staff did. In fact, he organized a counterattack. A move so brazen, Napoleon himself did not believe the initial reports that the Russians were advancing. As he raised his spyglass to watch his own men fighting off this counterattack, the Emperor couldn't help but admire them, saying, quote, "What audacity! What audacity!" end quote. As the situation now stood, if Napoleon had infantry on hand to exploit Murat's charge, this episode would probably be almost over. If only a few thousand foot soldiers had advanced into the gaping hole in the Russian position, Bennigsen's main line would have been broken in two, and he would have had little choice but to fall back. Even after the destruction of Augereau's corps, the Emperor still had his Imperial Guard available, but these were his last reserves, and Napoleon felt he couldn't risk committing them, knowing that the Russians might be reinforced by their Prussian allies at any moment. Some modern historians have criticized this decision, but Napoleon felt it wasn't worth the risk. And so, despite all its glory and all the chaos and devastation it had sown in the Russian lines, Murat's charge was not a battle-winning maneuver. Once again, the Grande Armée and their Russian enemies had traded blow for blow, inflicting terrible damage on each other, but neither side had been able to land a knockout. The Battle of Eylau would not be decided here. While all this drama unfolded in the center of the battlefield, there was serious action on Napoleon's right as well. Davout and Third Corps were pushing slowly but steadily into the Russian left. There was nothing flashy about the combat in this sector, just two forces of veteran soldiers slugging it out. There were several small villages in this area, and their buildings became strong points for the Russian defenders. Third Corps advanced, but repeated enemy counterattacks forced Davout to keep a strong reserve, preventing him from deploying his full force in the main line. The Russians had the artillery advantage in this sector. Davout's gunners struggled heroically to take out the enemy guns, or at least provide a distraction, but there was no way to prevent them from pouring fire into the helpless French infantry. After only a few hours of fighting, General Charles-Antoine Morand, who commanded an infantry division in Third Corps, reported that his advance units were down to 50% strength. And remember, it had only been a few months since Third Corps had fought off an entire Prussian army at Auerstedt. There had not been much time to rest and wait for replacements since that terrible day, and most of the corps' units were still badly depleted. Still, despite fierce resistance, Davout's men pushed forward. The Russians kept giving up ground, but did not break. Third Corps was, in effect, bending the Russian line. After a few hours, some Russian units in this sector were arranged almost perpendicular to the main line. The Russian army had bent almost 90 degrees, and the French now occupied much of the high ground in this sector. Despite the horrific failure of Augereau's attack in the morning, it was beginning to look like Napoleon and the Grande Armée would snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. The Russian center was still reeling from the charge, and their left was falling back. Davout and Third Corps were now dangerously close to the main road back to Königsberg, the main base of operations for all of the coalition forces in this area. If that bending line on the Russian left flank finally broke, which looked like it was only a matter of time, Davout and his men would be able to sever the road, and stream directly into the Russian rear. Between the blizzard and all the chaotic fighting, a huge proportion of the Russian soldiers had become separated from their units. Many were no longer fighting, but without their own officers to lead them, had simply gone to the rear, to await further instructions, and mostly to get away from all the deadly combat along the main line. Russian officers tried to rally these men, but had little success. The army was nearing the limits of its endurance. A dark mood was beginning to set in among the Russian ranks. Defeat was in the air. The French were now so close to Bennigsen's headquarters that it was coming under artillery fire. A senior Russian general begged Bennigsen to move. Using the familiar Russian form of the commander's name, he said, quote, "My dear Leonti, you will be struck dead like a lazy dog, and that won't do anyone any good. You should get out of this hellhole before it's too late." End quote. Begrudgingly, Bennigsen took his advice and moved his headquarters deeper into the rear. Unfortunately for the Russians, this led to rumors that he had fled the battlefield, another blow to morale. The Russian army needed a miracle, and they got it. Just when collapse was beginning to look inevitable, General Lestock and his Prussians began to arrive in the Russian rear. The appearance of their allies reinvigorated the Russians. Many of those stragglers picked up their muskets and fell in line with Lestock's regiments. Barely a year earlier, Emperor Alexander had been determined to invade and conquer Prussia, but now the two countries' soldiers were marching into battle side by side. Bennigsen deployed Lestock's division on his stricken left. Soon, they stabilized the line, and before long, DeVue and Third Corps were giving up ground. Now the coalition line was bending back the other direction. News of the Prussians' arrival on the battlefield was a terrible blow to French morale. By now, the fighting had picked up again in the center of the battlefield. Once again, Napoleon's headquarters came under threat. Some officers began to question whether or not the Emperor should move further to the rear, or call forward the infantry of his Imperial Guard to drive the enemy away. They were informed that the army's morale was so fragile that Napoleon worried deploying the guard or departing from his headquarters might create a general panic and lose him the battle. Fortunately for the French, some nearby cavalry under General Grouchy were able to drive away the most threatening enemy units. All was not lost for the French. At almost the exact same time Lestock and the Prussians arrived, the Grande Armée received reinforcements as well. Marshal Ney and his 6th Corps had arrived on the battlefield. It was actually not a coincidence that these two formations arrived at Eylau at almost the same time. You might remember from episode 99 that Marshal Ney had been ordered to shadow the Prussians and try to prevent them from linking up with Bennigsen. A skillful Prussian rearguard had prevented him from achieving the second part of his mission, but he had shadowed them right to the battlefield. As soon as 6th Corps was formed up, the bold, red-haired marshal immediately led them into an attack along the Russian right, and the fighting in this sector intensified again. Mercifully, night comes early in northeastern Europe at this time of the year. By late afternoon, the light was beginning to fade. The sun set at around 5:30. Combat continued all along the line, but with both armies exhausted and demoralized, and visibility getting even worse, the action began to slow down. Like many engagements of this campaign, the second day of the Battle of Eylau slowly petered out rather than reaching a decisive ending point. Behind the Russian lines, a group of wounded officers was lying in a makeshift hospital, discussing the events they had just barely survived. One of them remarked, quote, "I don't think one can envision any worse massacre between the children of Adam than the one that occurred today," end quote. One of his comrades chimed in, quote, "If anyone tried to surpass today's butchery, Satan himself would never allow it, for he exhausted all his devilish skills today, and what a job he did." End quote. By around 10 o'clock, the two armies were disengaged, and the firing had more or less stopped. At about 11, things had calmed down enough for Bennigsen to assemble his senior officers for a council of war. One question dominated the agenda. Should the Allied army use the cover of darkness to retreat, or should they hold their ground and square off against the French again in the morning? Remember, the Battle of Hoth had taken place the day before the first day of combat at Eylau, so if the Russians stayed, that would make 4 days of consecutive hard fighting. Despite the dire condition of their troops, many of the assembled generals argued for this course of action. They felt the arrival of Lestock had turned the tide of the battle, and that with another day, they could deal the Grande Armée its first major defeat. The issue was discussed for quite some time, but Bennigsen did not share their confidence. At around midnight, the outposts of Third Corps began to hear movement in the Russian lines. Fearing an attack, they informed Marshal Davout, who came forward personally to see what the fuss was about. The marshal placed an ear to the frozen ground and listened for a few seconds, then told his troops they were mistaken. The sounds of marching men and trotting horses were getting fainter, not louder. The enemy was in retreat. Once again, the Russians had stood their ground in the face of ferocious attacks, only to slip away in the night. The Battle of Eylau was over. Between the darkness and the blizzard, with the French cavalry tired and battered from their charge, there was little chance of a successful pursuit, and Napoleon soon called it off. The two armies passed another uncomfortable and mostly sleepless night. The French hunkered down in the ruins of Eylau, surrounded by the wounded and the dead, and the Russians slogging through the blizzard in the dark. By morning, the snowstorm had finally subsided, and the men of the Grande Armée got their first clear view of the carnage all around them. Compared to many of the battles we've covered, Eylau was fought in a very small geographic area. With so many casualties occurring in this cramped space, the bodies had literally stacked up. Huge mounds of dead soldiers were scattered across the battlefield, often marking the places where entire units had been wiped out all at once. When they found the remains of the 14th Regiment of the Line, who had given their eagle to Lieutenant Marbot, their square formation was still discernible in the mass of corpses where they had made their last stand. The Russian grenadiers had killed them all so fast there hadn't been time to break formation. In some places, these mounds of bodies had become truly grisly. Where the fighting was particularly ferocious, enemy soldiers had stabbed into them with bayonets, hoping to kill any wounded men trapped beneath. In other places, cavalry units had charged across them, or wagons had driven over them, mutilating the corpses. Even seasoned veterans were disgusted by the state of the battlefield. Even the army's surgeons, who saw more than their share of blood and gore, were horrified. Napoleon gathered his staff together, and they mounted up to ride around the battlefield and offer help to the wounded, as was his custom after a major engagement. Amazingly, there were wounded men still alive in this hellish landscape. Napoleon and his staff offered them brandy and whatever medical treatment they could. As he and his staff wandered, the emperor ran into Marshal Ney. Ney was an emotional man, and he was deeply affected by the horrible scenes all around him. He said, quote, "What a massacre, and without result," end quote. He was right. Despite 2 days of brutal combat and absolutely horrific casualties, the battle had achieved nothing. As Napoleon and his staff continued their ride, they got closer and closer to the areas where the most intense fighting had taken place. Soon, they found it impossible to navigate the ground without their horses stepping on the dead. Disgusted, Napoleon called a halt. Then the Emperor of the French began to cry. A few weeks later, he would write to his brother Joseph, one of the few people he was truly close to. He confided, quote, "Here we have war in all its fierceness and all its horrors," end quote. In his official bulletin after the battle, Napoleon claimed victory. In the most narrow technical sense, that might have been true. The Russians were the ones who retreated, leaving the French in control of the battlefield. But the plan to trap Bennigsen had failed completely, and at a terrible cost. However, the bulletin was surprisingly frank about the horrific fighting. When Police Minister Joseph Fouché read the bulletin, he told Napoleon that it would be too damaging to public opinion. Apparently Bonaparte didn't care, it was published anyway. As I'm sure you know by now, it was second nature for Napoleon to put his own spin on the truth, to put it diplomatically. And although he did his best to paint Eylau as a success and presented some very optimistic casualty estimates, he was surprisingly frank about the nature of the combat. Quote, "The slaughter was horrible," end quote. Both armies reported around 15,000 casualties. Almost all modern historians agree those numbers are far too low. As you might imagine, both commanders had strong incentive to downplay how many men they had sacrificed in a totally indecisive battle. high estimates are almost double the official numbers. Over 29,000 French casualties and over 26,000 Russian. If those high estimates are correct, around one-third of the men who fought at Eylau were killed or wounded. It is worth mentioning again that in Napoleonic warfare, only a fraction of the casualties were actually killed in action. For instance, that high estimate of over 29,000 French casualties places the number of men actually killed in action at just under 5,000. Still, by any measure, Eylau was a horrible slaughter. The men who took part in this battle would remember it as particularly vicious and bloody. For the second time in as many months, Napoleon ordered the Grande Armée to make winter quarters. Bennigsen did the same. Both armies would need months to rest, resupply, treat the wounded, and await fresh replacements from home. Despite the terrible calamity at Eylau, the wider war showed no signs of stopping anytime soon. Come spring, the fighting would continue. That's all for now. Before I go, I'll remind you once again to check out some of the other great podcasts on the Airwave Network, like The Constant, The Explorers Podcast, and The Conspirators. And don't forget to sign up on Patreon if you want access to the next dispatch, which will be out in a few weeks. Until next time, thanks for listening.